And now, obviously, our feeds are very algorithmically curated. There are algorithms that are going to be ranking and recommending content, and other algorithms that might be, for example, suppressing or removing certain kinds of content. And so I think it's really important to think about how have these algorithms, which generally the purpose is nothing to do with politics, right? The purpose is to just show people the content they find most relevant. How have these algorithms potentially had unintended consequences? And how have they perhaps even been manipulated by political actors for their gain?
This is Click to Trust, a podcast that delves into the intricate challenges of protecting online communities. In the last episode of Click to Trust, I spoke with Karishma Shah, program manager in charge of news integrity partnerships at Meta, about how online platforms like Facebook and Instagram are tackling misinformation and keeping their users safe. In this episode, we'll hear from computational sociologist Tom Davidson about the impact of social media on politics and how populist parties benefit from online spaces. In the 2010s, two big items shook up the political sphere. First, the use of social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter skyrocketed, shaking up politics both for voters and politicians by turning these spaces into a massive space for debate and campaigning. Second, we saw populist parties gaining traction worldwide, propelling the election of leaders such as Rodrigo Duterte from Philippines, Donald Trump in the United States, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. Today, I'm sitting down with Tom Davidson, a computational sociologist at Rutgers University, to talk about how political movements use social media to their advantage. So, Tom, let's get right into it. How has social media changed politics?
Hi, Carmo. Thanks for having me on the podcast. So I think there are several ways of thinking about this question. I'm going to list, I think, three different important factors. The first is we should think about how social media has affected the way citizens engage with politics. We saw this, I think, most directly in the Arab Spring and the Occupy movements in the early 2010s when we saw these mass protests organized online on platforms like Facebook. And now we see that many people use social media to receive political news, to share information, to talk about politics. And it's become one of the primary means where we find out about political information. Second, I think it's important to think about this from the perspective of politicians or political parties. Social media alters the way that they can interact with the public and creates these new channels for interaction. And I think that political elites were a little slower to adopt social media than populations. I think we first saw these social movements, bottom-up processes, and later politicians saw the value of social media. And we saw this, I think, most viscerally when Donald Trump adopted Twitter as his megaphone during his campaign and presidency. And the third component of this, which I think is important, is the way that platforms themselves have potentially shaped politics throughout the way that social media can potentially act as echo chambers or filter bubbles where they can reinforce people's political views. They're thinking about how different kinds of information and things like misinformation and fake news can spread online in ways that didn't really happen to the same extent using kind of legacy media. And also now thinking about the role of algorithms and amplifying certain kinds of information. So I think it's important to think of social media as something that shaped politics, both for bottom-up processes and top-down, but also to think about the role of these technological factors that are perhaps distinct from other kinds of media.
You mentioned populist parties, and I want to take a quick step back. This might sound like a setup to a joke, but how can you tell a populist from a non-populist?
So that's a great question. And I think populism is something that is potentially inherent in all politics. All sorts of politicians from time to time make populist appeals. So I think the way to think about politics, the way that's informed my view, is a theory from Dutch political scientist Cas Mudde. He sees populism as a particular type of political appeal. It's an appeal where politicians often construct this grievance between the pure people and the corrupt elite. And so politics is often framed as this kind of dichotomy between the people and the elite. And this is something that potentially all kinds of politicians do. But there are some politicians who rely on this type of discourse much more heavily than others. And so those are the politicians we consider populists. And what's important here is populism doesn't necessarily imply any particular kind of ideology. So Mudah calls populism a thin ideology. So the idea is that populist appeals can be combined with other types of ideology, from socialism to potentially very right-wing appeals. For example, if we think about left-wing populism, it might involve the elite, financial elites, for example. So we saw this in the austerity movements against austerity in Europe after the Great Recession. Occupy Wall Street and that kind of trope of the 1% would be an example of this. And then we also see today right-wing populism, often the elites are framed as enabling things like mass migration. And so there's a very different kind of discourse on the right.
The reason they might become so popular online is also because if you're an established politician, you have to be a bit more careful with the words that you use and what you say. You have more to lose. And populists, they have more to win. Could you explain like how populist politicians are benefiting from online spaces?
So I think certainly part of this is the fact that populists are often outsiders. So perhaps they can make claims that more established politicians are unable to make. I think the important thing about social media is that it enables this kind of direct interface between the politician and the people in a way that somewhat is unprecedented. And this is actually one of the key characteristics of populism beyond Mudah's theory. There's another kind of school of thought on populism that is largely based on analyses of Latin American populism and leaders like Hugo Chavez. And the idea here is that populism is a type of strategy where a politician seeks this direct, unmediated connection with the people. And so we see that social media potentially allows politicians to communicate directly. They're not necessarily worried about how mainstream media might cover them, but they have this interface directly with their supporters. And so that's one of the reasons why scholars think that social media is particularly advantageous for populists, as it has this kind of affinity between the nature of populist appeals and the nature of the media structure. Now, in terms of why do these types of appeals resonate so much with online audiences, I think there are a few different factors. We know from scholarship, looking at what kinds of content get high engagement, that negative appeals, often negative emotional appeals, seem to really resonate with online audiences. And another study has found that attacks against outgroups, so we can see different politicians attack different outgroups. For example, if we're thinking about conservatives, often this might be liberals or it might be immigrants, that these types of attacks really seem to attract a lot of engagement, a disproportionate share of engagement. So it seems that there really is something to do with an affinity between the types of appeals populists make and things that tend to attract a lot of engagement online.
What do those appeals look like? What does populist discourse look like? Is it hate speech, misinformation? And you mentioned it leads to a lot of engagement because people tend to interact more with negative comments. Why is that? What does that look like? Can you give some examples?
So I think hate speech might be an extreme example here. Certainly we've seen with some of, for example, Donald Trump's discourse on Twitter, where he's very directly attacking political opponents, criticizing people, calling them names. That type of appeal seems to really generate a lot of engagement. And there are still questions about exactly what the mechanisms are, right? Some of this is going to be driven by supporters of Donald Trump who really agree with the message. But also there are arguments that perhaps other people going and commenting and arguing and perhaps critiquing what politicians are saying, this still is counted as engagement, which then attracts algorithmic amplification. So it's possible that even opposing these populist messages still benefits these actors in the long term. In terms of, is this misinformation? I don't think this is always misinformation, but certainly one of the features of populist narratives is that often these quite simple black and white explanations for complex political phenomena, and often that I think that can lead to perhaps making some false or misleading claims. And certainly we know from studies that there was a study published in Science in 2018 that found that misinformation on Twitter spread faster, deeper through the network and kind of more broadly than actual factual information on the platform. So it's possible that if populist leaders are also using misinformation, that this kind of enables this content to really spread and attract a large audience. I think it's also important to note how some of these actors are very strategic in the kinds of messaging they're using on social media. So in some of my research, I've studied far-right activists in the United Kingdom, and they would post these very simple messages. For example, they might share a picture of the Queen or share a picture supporting the military and saying, like and share this picture if you support the Queen or you love the British military. And so lots of people like and share this content, not realizing that they're then potentially amplifying these more extreme views. And as this spreads through the network, it becomes perhaps detached from the original creator of the message, and it becomes easier for other people to share without necessarily agreeing with the underlying political message.
I want to double click on this algorithmic amplification, because at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned that social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram kind of changed everything. But was it really social media and these spaces being created online, or was it the algorithms rewarding engagement that has led to where we are now?
I think that's a very important question and one that's still an open question. As someone who's been studying social media for a while, I can say that until the last few years, there really hasn't been very much attention paid to the algorithms themselves. So when we think about something like the Occupy movement or the Arab Spring, the way that scholars have generally thought about these is that social media enable people to form these very large movements by mobilizing their online networks. So suddenly when we have large numbers of, for example, young people on Facebook, it becomes easy for people to mobilize their networks and spread information and protest. We think about the role of social media here as really just an organizing tool that it is enabling people to spread messages and to share events and so on. And early social media, there weren't many algorithmic mechanisms that actually controlling how content was shown. For example, early Twitter and early Facebook, people had a reverse chronological feed. And so you just see the most recent content that has been shared by your network. And now, obviously, our feeds are very algorithmically curated. There are algorithms that are going to be ranking and recommending content, and other algorithms that might be, for example, suppressing or removing certain kinds of content. And so I think it's really important to think about how have these algorithms, which generally the purpose is nothing to do with politics, right? The purpose is to just show people the content they find most relevant. How have these algorithms potentially had unintended consequences? And how have they perhaps even been manipulated by political actors for their gain? And this, from an academic perspective, is extremely hard to study, right? We even need to collaborate with platforms and gain access to their algorithms. And so there was a study published a couple of years ago where researchers had collaborated with Twitter. And for a group of users, they were able to switch them to a reverse chronological feed versus the ranked feed. And they found that depending on the feed, there were differences in people's political engagement. So actually they found that right-wing political groups in Europe tended to get more visibility under the algorithmic ranking. But these studies are very hard to do, and that study actually didn't find those extremist groups tended to benefit from the algorithms. They found that in general, kind of mainstream right-wing parties did seem to benefit. But we still don't know very much about the extent to which algorithms have benefited really extremist groups. Often the best we can do as academics is look from the outside and identify when platforms are open about changes to their algorithms. We can then perhaps see whether a change led to any observable shift in engagement. So for example, there was a study that looked at Facebook's shift in 2018, where the platform pivoted to what they called emphasizing meaningful social interactions. And this was partly to try and remedy some of the problems that occurred in the 2016 election. And the researchers actually found that Facebook's changes to its algorithms were associated with an increase in engagement to Republican pages in the United States. So that study, although we can't perfectly identify the role of the algorithms, does suggest that they are having an effect on political engagement. So this is a very open area of research and something that people are thinking about right now.
It's really important to have this conversation, because often we see social media and these spaces as they did create such an opportunity for online discourse and for people to find their people who maybe were feeling lonely in real life and not connected in terms of ideas to other people. But the truth is that the algorithm really changes everything. And for me, listening to you talking about populist discourse, it seems like the perfect storm. If you have an algorithm that rewards engagement and you have content that's going to incite reactions because it's negative or because it's strong, at least not neutral, then obviously that's going to lead to some of the things we're seeing today. Do you know how the engagement compares of populist politicians versus non-populists? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I can tell you about a recent study that I've been working on along with a graduate student in my department, Jenny Enos. So we sought to investigate whether populists do actually get more engagement across major platforms than other political parties. So here we focus on parties, largely because we were able to collect more data on parties than on politicians. For politicians, it's easy potentially to get data on the current politicians, but we found it very hard to go back. And what we wanted to do in our study was really look over time across a range of countries at how engagement with different policies had varied. Because previous studies in this area had largely focused on a handful of parties, often in countries with strong populist presences, places like France, Italy, and Germany. And often these studies had only focused on very narrow periods. So just analyzing discourse or online engagement during an election when we expect that people are going to be very active online. And so we collected data on over 400 parties across 30 countries in Europe and compared engagement with populist and non-populist parties. I'm happy to talk more about how we did that side of things. We compared engagement with these parties. And what we found was on Facebook, populist political parties tend to get around twice as much engagement as non-populist parties. So this is double the number of likes, double the number of shares, double the number of comments compared to other parties. On Twitter, we had also expected to see a relationship, but we actually found much less compelling evidence that there were any populist advantages. So overall, we didn't see the populists attracted more engagement than other parties, although we did observe some patterns in a handful of countries.
Do you have any hypothesis on why there is such a difference between Facebook and Twitter?
So we think that this is largely to do with the way the platforms are used. So across just about every country in Europe, Facebook is by far the most widely used social media platform, whereas Twitter is used much more selectively. So in certain countries, Twitter has a relatively high user base, and in other countries, very few people tend to use Twitter. And we also suspect that there are differences in the kinds of people that use these platforms. So Facebook, because it has such a broad reach, it has a very wide variation in the kinds of people that use the platform. And so there are all sorts of demographics, whereas Twitter is often used by younger, more highly educated people who are interested in finding out about the news and current affairs. And so we think that the audience on Twitter is potentially less receptive to populist appeals, and that perhaps the kinds of people that populists really want to reach are just much less likely to be on Twitter in a lot of countries. Now, this was surprising to us, I think, because our approach is very informed by thinking about the US context, where, for example, Twitter was very central to Donald Trump. So I think it's important to pay attention to different contexts and the way that different platforms are used. And we can't just generalize what's happening on one platform in one country and expect to see the same kinds of results in other countries.
Could you speak about TikTok? Because I'm in Lisbon, Portugal right now, which is where I'm from, and we just had elections a couple of weeks ago, and our right-wing populist party, Chega, grew quite astronomically compared to the last election. They didn't win the election, but they are considered the winners of this election. And there are a lot of conversations from people my age saying they were the only party that was on TikTok. And I actually had no idea. I don't use TikTok. It's too addictive. But do we know anything about that and how that's influencing maybe young voters?
Certainly in our data, we also saw that Chega was very popular on Facebook. So I don't think this is just a story about a single platform. But I think TikTok is certainly an area that requires a lot of investigation. We just at this point don't know very much. I think there are some countervailing pressures that we imagine TikTok has a very young audience, and young people are often not the primary audience for populist parties. But certainly if parties like Chega are really capitalizing on TikTok and investing much more in the medium, then they might have a lot of success on the platform, at least until it becomes more widely adopted by a broader array of groups. And I think there's something about the visual medium that's very important to consider here. I talked about how social media in general, there's potentially an affinity between the way populists like to communicate and the way that social media works. And I think that perhaps it is even more true when we think about video-based platforms, where people can really interact directly with politicians, can speak directly to the people, and they can do it in this very informal, personalized way that might be similar to the way we have a FaceTime conversation with our friends. So I think that platforms like TikTok could be a very effective way for populists to communicate. Certainly, there's been some research looking at Instagram, and similar findings to what I talked about on Facebook have been shown on Instagram. There's been an effective medium. Mm-hmm. So this is still an open question because the platform's so young, but I think it's very important to investigate.
Yeah, and it's probably really hard to study when it comes to video. I'd love to actually go back and for you to talk a little bit about how this research is conducted when you're looking at different platforms, different accounts, the discourse that they're using, how you're looking at language, and then coming to conclusions such as that populist parties are getting more engagement.
Yeah. So I think one thing that's important to emphasize, perhaps taking a step back, is how do researchers actually collect this kind of data?
Yeah.
And so much of the data we collect, particularly if we want to do these kinds of large-scale studies, it is based on using APIs or application programming interfaces provided by platforms. And so these are systems that allow us to go and download relatively large volumes of data. And so our research was conducted by using the Facebook CrowdTangle API and Twitter's Academic API. And this kind of research really only works because platforms provide access. And unfortunately, what's been happening recently is platforms have been cutting access. So Facebook have just announced that they're going to close down the CrowdTangle API this summer. And there's potentially a replacement, but it sounds like the replacement might not come soon enough, particularly in a year that's very important with all these elections going on across the world. And Twitter, after it was taken over by Elon Musk, has completely shut down its Academic API. They were providing free access to academics, and now they're charging tens of thousands of dollars to access it, which makes it really out of reach. So it's very important thing about the data collection. In the case of TikTok, TikTok does have an Academic API, which academics are able to apply to use. But there's been some discussion about restrictions in the way that they provide data that might make it actually quite difficult to use. So when we do have APIs available, we're often able to go and collect things like the text from tweets, the text from Facebook posts, along with, for example, counts of the number of people who've liked and shared that content. And so with TikTok, this could include descriptions of videos and potentially also the video itself. And so in my case, our analyses, we looked as a very macro level. You can think of this as we were looking from 30,000 feet at what was going on. And so we were looking really at aggregate patterns of engagement. But there's a lot of other research looking more specifically at the content. And so researchers are using various different techniques for computational text analysis to go and analyze certain kinds of discourse. So, for example, to identify which posts actually contain attacks against outgroups or which posts contain populist themes. Often this involves using machine learning to detect these kinds of content. And then we can conduct statistical analyses to look at the relationship between these types of content and, for example, engagement or follow accounts and so on. And so the point you make about video is interesting. Video has been typically much more difficult to analyze because we don't have good tools for analyzing video. But I think now, with some of the recent advances in machine learning and AI, we're starting to get methods that we can actually use to analyze these videos. And for example, we might be able to take a TikTok video and identify whether a politician is using populist messaging or using negative emotional appeals in that video. And so this is a very interesting open area of methodological research that's currently in progress, both in academia and I'm sure within tech platforms. That TikTok also has its own internal classifiers that they're working on to try and identify what types of content are used. Is a video actually using, for example, misinformation that the platform might want to take action against?
It's a shame that some of these APIs are getting shut down or changing, because why is it important that we do study these things and understand online discourse and engagement? especially in the year of all elections?
As I think we all know now, these platforms have a tremendous impact on the way that people discuss politics, people find out information, and potentially the way that people behave and people vote in elections. And so I think the impact of social media on politics and potentially on democracy is just so huge that we need to have a lot of scrutiny. I think it's important that platforms are more transparent and release more information and share reports on what they're doing in this space. But we also need lots of independent research. I don't think we can just leave it to platforms to report. We've seen with all of the media coverage over the last few years that there have been all sorts of problems inside social media platforms that we've only really found out about due to investigative journalism and due to people leaking information. And so I think it's really important that we have access to data that we can use to evaluate what's going on the platforms and assess how well a platform's doing at things like clamping down on the sharing of misinformation or enabling different kinds of political speech. I think there are very valid concerns about the way content moderation works and how content moderation is impacting people's legitimate political speech in different contexts. And so I think it's really important that we have a lot of scrutiny and oversight. And in some contexts, in Europe, for example, we're seeing more of a move towards regulation and rules that mean that platforms have to share more data and have to be more transparent and have to provide access to researchers. That hasn't quite happened in the United States yet. Platforms have stronger protections, but we're certainly seeing a lot more scrutiny that might be pushing us in that direction.
And you mentioned being able to use AI tools to also do this research and look at data, for example, analyzing video. Are there any other roles that AI-generated content is playing in the conversation we've just had? I guess the spread of content by populist parties, I would say. And what role is it playing in all this?
I think it's important when we talk about the use of AI in politics. I think at the moment, you know, we're in a period where there's a lot of hype and potentially also fear-mongering. And I do think there are legitimate risks. But I think it's important to distinguish between different kinds of uses of AI, right? So we can imagine there are many legitimate uses of these tools. For example, smaller parties or political candidates with fewer resources might be making use of AI to help produce campaign materials or to produce, for example, different versions of emails to use in A/B testing. And so I think these things have lots of legitimate uses. Things get more complicated when we start to think about AI to generate campaign imagery or videos. And we need to think carefully about what kinds of uses are permissible. So, for example, last year, the Republican National Committee made a campaign ad that speculated about the future if Joe Biden wins the 2024 election. And they actually used AI-generated images to create a montage. And so in that case, if you go on the YouTube video, you can see they describe it as AI generated, although there's nothing in the video to actually suggest it's AI generated. You have to go and read the description. So I think we still haven't arrived at clear norms for when content needs to be flagged. I know some platforms, Meta, for example, is saying that Facebook and Instagram are going to flag AI generated content. But this is an open area. And obviously, the biggest risks are where people use AI-generated content to make deep fakes, these images or videos or recordings that are passed off as genuine information. And I think that certainly is an emerging risk. And we've seen this already, for example, with robocalls that we used during the New Hampshire primary. So it will be interesting to see how these types of tools are used across the board. I can't say for sure at this point whether it might make more use of these tools than any other political actors. I think one area that's interesting to think about here in the context of populism is that populists, I think ironically, despite the fact that populists have often been advantaged by social media, have also been very anti-big tech. And big tech factors into populist discourse that this is another elite group that populists can rail against. And we see this with Donald Trump's attacks against Facebook, against Twitter, and attacks more broadly against the way that the social media companies are allegedly censoring certain kinds of political speech. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this extends into thinking about AI and generative AI companies. For example, just a few weeks ago, there was a story in the New York Times about how Google's new Gemini model was creating images that, for example, people were alleging were showing ahistorical images due to the way that the company was trying to de-bias models. And, for example, were not representing white people in certain images. And so there were conservatives who were drawing attention to this and saying, look, this is about political correctness in big tech and political correctness in AI. And so I think it's easy to see how AI tools and potentially the companies behind these tools become another kind of target, both of this kind of culture war and of populist ire. So I think that might be one area of this space to pay attention to.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're still at the beginning. We're still figuring all of this out. This has been a really fascinating conversation. And before we go, what would you like our listeners to know as we navigate through such a big election year and as these new technologies emerge?
You said it's an important election year. We have more than half of the world's population, if I understand it right, is going to be voting in elections this year. And so on the one hand, I think hopefully major platforms have learned from some of their past mistakes, have a better sense of the election integrity work that needs to happen. And so hopefully we're going to see more safeguards in place. But at the same time, I think social media has really radically changed over the last couple of years. We know that major platforms like Meta, for example, have potentially scaled back some of their integrity teams. Twitter has fired most of its moderation staff and infrastructure. And we've seen this fragmentation of audiences across different platforms, from Blue Sky to Truth Social. And also many people are using other more closed platforms to get political information, things like WhatsApp and Telegram. And these platforms tend to be much harder to monitor. I think this kind of era of fragmentation of social media really does create new risks and challenges that we don't properly understand. And so I think it's important for people to pay attention to different kinds of platforms, think about how information they're receiving or how news we're accessing might differ. And we really need to think about potentially scrutinizing platforms further and thinking about what they can do to make online media, make social media a better space for political dialogue and discourse. So I think there's a lot to be paying attention to at the moment, and there are lots of new emerging challenges as well as the issues that we now kind of pay more attention to. So it's going to be a very interesting year to see how politics is taking place across social media.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like the attitude going into this year, well, we're already a third of the way through, but is being curious, paying attention, reading. I think questioning what we see. We don't have to question everything, but we know at this point how the algorithms work. And with AI gen, things are changing definitely. And we just need to keep an eye out.
Yeah. And it's a truly global scale this year. We shouldn't just think about platforms in one context, but the way all of these different platforms are being used across different countries. It's very important to pay attention to that kind of context and not just try to make broad generalizations across different platforms.
Thank you, Tom. This has been wonderful. I'll see you maybe next time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
On the next episode of Click to Trust, we'll continue to dissect the topic of misinformation as we face one of the biggest years of elections on a global scale. Thank you for tuning in, and see you next time.